There is this this very specific, almost physical sensation that happens when you're, well, say you're standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon,
Oh, yeah.
or when you're just out in the absolute middle of nowhere, like miles from any city lights,
Yes.
and you're looking up at a sky that is just completely thick with stars.
Right. It's overwhelming.
Yeah. But you can even get it sitting in your living room, honestly. Like when you put on a piece of music that suddenly feels entirely too large for the physical space you're in, time sort of loosens its grip. You feel vanishingly tiny, but at the exact same moment, you feel strangely anchored and connected to everything around you.
Yeah, it's a profound shift.
And your own personal immediate worries, right? Like your inbox, the argument you had with a friend yesterday, the dent in your car, they just go completely quiet.
They do. The whole, the insistent heavy weight of being you just suddenly drops away.
Yes,
And we've
exact.
all felt some version of it,
Yeah.
but culturally, we've always treated it as this sort of vague, poetic mood.
Right, like so something for writers.
Exactly. It's treated like a philosophical luxury or, something meant for poets and artists to try and capture in a painting rather than a hard, measurable phenomenon for scientists to actually put under a microscope.
Okay, let's unpack this because today's deep dive is exploring a single wildly fascinating article published today, August 21st, 2026, in the OOTW Journal.
It's a great piece.
It really is. And our mission here is to understand the actual hard neuroscience behind that exact sensation, the emotion of awe. We are going to look at the mechanics of how it radically alters human behavior, what it is physically doing inside the school, and its incredibly surprising scientific link to psychedelics.
Yeah, that part is wild.
Because it turns out that feeling you get staring at the Milky Way is a highly specific, deeply evolved psychological instrument.
It really is. And, for most of the history of modern psychology, awe was essentially left out of the textbooks.
Really? Completely left out.
Pretty much, yeah. The
Yeah.
focus was heavily skewed toward the basic survival emotions.
Like fear and stuff.
Right. Researchers spent decades mapping fear, anger, joy, disgust, the things that ostensibly keep an organism alive or help it reproduce.
That makes sense.
Yeah, but awe just seemed like a byproduct of human cognition, like a luxury emotion. But in 2003, two researchers, Dantra Keltner and Jonathan Haidt, they fundamentally changed that paradigm and put awe on the scientific map.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they published a paper arguing that awe isn't just a synonym for surprise and it's not just a heightened state of joy.
Okay.
For an experience to actually trigger the neurology of awe, they found it requires two very specific measurable ingredients.
Right. And the first one feels fairly intuitive when you think about the Grand Canyon example. They called it perceived vastness.
Exactly. You have to encounter something that absolutely dwarfs you. You have to feel like you are in the presence of something far larger than your own, habitual frame of reference.
Right.
And they were careful to note this doesn't just mean physical size, like a towering mountain range or standing inside a massive cathedral.
Oh, so it can be other things.
Yeah, it can be vast in mathematical complexity, like trying to comprehend string theory,
Right, sure.
or it can be vast in human ability, like watching an Olympic gymnast do something that just seems to defy physics.
Yeah, like how is a human body doing that?
Exactly. Or it can be vast in meaning. But it's the sheer, undeniable scale of the thing that hits your sensory systems first.
Right, but I mean, I can feel small standing next to a massive skyscraper in a corporate financial district, and I wouldn't say I feel awe.
No, probably not.
I just feel like I'm near a big building. Which is where that second ingredient comes in, and this is the concept from the article that I found so sticky. Keltner and Haidt called it the need for accommodation.
Yes, and this is where the actual mechanics of the emotion happen.
Okay.
So they borrowed the term accommodation from the famous developmental psychologist Jean Piaget.
Right, Piaget.
Yeah. Piaget theorized that our minds are entirely reliant on mental structures or schemas to make sense of reality.
Like a framework.
Exactly. We all carry around a mental map of how the world works, how people behave, what the rules of physics are.
Right.
And most of the time, when we encounter new information, we just assimilate it.
Okay.
The new data just slots neatly right into the pre-existing map.
Got it.
But occasionally, we encounter an experience so vast and so completely outside our current understanding that our existing mental structures literally cannot contain it.
So wait, is assimilation like putting a new book on a bookshelf, but accommodation is realizing the book is actually a king-size mattress and you have to knock down the walls of your house just to make it fit?
That is the exact mechanism,
Yeah.
yes.
Wow.
The mind's map is being forced to grow because the frame you were using to view reality just an hour ago is suddenly obsolete.
That's crazy.
Awe is the specific emotion we feel in that exact, precise split second when the mind's map is being forced to expand.
Oh, wow.
It's the neurological feeling of the frame breaking and reforming.
Which makes total sense of why awe feels like a door suddenly blowing open in your mind.
Exactly.
But if awe is the process that forces our mental map of the world to expand, that brings up a really interesting consequence for the thing sitting at the absolute center of that map, right? Like our own ego.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we see this reliably across almost all the modern psychological literature on awe. Researchers refer to it as the small self.
The small self. Okay.
Yeah. If the world suddenly looms incredibly large, complex, and profound, the self, by contrast, has to shrink.
Right.
When you are genuinely trying to accommodate the sheer scale of a redwood forest, your upcoming dental appointment, or your anxiety is about a work presentation, they suddenly cannot sustain their position at the center of the universe.
It's just psychological relativity. Like, the background gets huge, so the foreground has to get tiny.
Perfectly said. And this isn't just a subjective, fleeting feeling. It has a measurable moral shape.
Moral shape? What do you mean?
Well, the OTW Journal article highlights a landmark 2015 study by Paul Piff, Datcher Keltner, and their colleagues that really proved this. Across five different studies, they induced awe in thousands of people to see what would happen to their behavior.
How do you induce awe in a lab?
Good question. In one of the most famous experiments, they took participants out to the UC Berkeley campus. Half the group was instructed to stand in a grove of towering 200-foot-tall eucalyptus trees and just look up for a minute.
Okay, pretty straightforward.
Yeah. And the control group was instructed to stand in the exact same area, but look up in a tall, generic building instead.
Okay, and this is where the experimental design gets clever.
Right. An experimenter then walked past the participants and accidentally dropped a box of pens on the ground.
Oops.
Yeah, oops. They wanted to measure, in real time, who would stop to help a stranger and how much help they would actually offer.
Okay, that's really smart.
They also ran variations of this where people watched vast natural scenes on a screen or played economic games where they had to divide up resources between themselves and strangers.
And the results they published are wild.
Mm-hmm.
The participants who had just experienced awe, like the ones looking at the eucalyptus trees or the nature documentaries, they were measurably more generous in sharing resources.
Mm-hmm.
They made more ethical decisions in lab games. They scored lower on tests measuring psychological entitlement, and they picked up significantly more dropped pens for the stranger.
It's a huge shift in behavior.
But wait, so just looking up at some really tall trees magically makes someone more likely to share their lunch or act ethically?
I know, it sounds...
I mean, I'm struggling with the leap from staring at a big tree to suddenly, I'm a deeply ethical person sharing my resources, though. That feels like a massive stretch to say A causes B. How do researchers actually prove causation there rather than just noticing a correlation between people who like nature and people who are nice?
What's fascinating here is how the statistical modeling answered that exact skepticism.
Okay.
The researchers ran mediation analyses to figure out why the tree lookers were picking up more pens.
Aww. Mm-hmm.
They proved that the diminished ego is the active ingredient.
Really?
Yeah. It's not that the trees themselves radiate some sort of calming moral energy or that nature lovers are just inherently better people.
Right, right.
It's that the experience of awe forcefully shrinks the felt importance of the ego.
Okay.
Our self-obsession, our constant rumination on our own needs, and our baseline sense of personal entitlement, those are the primary cognitive barriers standing in the way of us noticing someone else's dropped pens or offering them a fair share of resources.
It's like the ego is a dam blocking the natural river of our pro-social behavior, and awe just temporarily lifts the gate.
Yes. When awe removes that barrier by shrinking the self, our evolutionary drive to cooperate and help one another just flows out.
Wow.
Awe makes us better to one another precisely because it forces us, for a moment, to be less obsessed with ourselves.
That's fascinating.
And from an evolutionary perspective, this makes perfect sense. Early humans needed to cooperate in large, complex social groups to survive.
Right, you can't survive alone.
Exactly. So awe might have evolved as a mechanism to occasionally override our selfish, individualistic impulses so we could work together in the face of vast challenges.
That is a beautiful idea, but we are still talking largely in the realm of psychology and observable behavior here.
Yeah.
If awe subjectively shrinks the self, and changes our physical actions that drastically, there has to be an objective structural change happening in the actual hardware of the brain. You can't have a massive software shift without the hardware doing something different.
Absolutely. If the felt sense of the self goes quiet, you would expect the specific brain system responsible for generating that self to also go quiet.
Right.
And in modern neuroscience, the system that constructs our ongoing sense of me is known as the default mode network, or the DMN.
We see the DMN pop up constantly when we look at behavioral brain science.
Oh, all the time. It's a set of interconnected midline regions in the brain, heavily anchored in the medial prefrontal cortex.
Okay.
The DMN is the network that hums to life whenever you aren't engaged in a specific demanding external task.
So like when you're just zoning out.
Yeah, exactly. If you're just sitting on a bus staring out the window, your DMN is highly active.
Oh, interesting.
It's responsible for self-referential thought, mental time travel,
ruminating
on the past, worrying about the future, constructing autobiographical memories, and just running that constant, never-ending internal narration of your own life.
So it's basically the voice in my head.
Yes. It is the neurological seat of the ego.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because the OTW source dives into a 2019 brain scanning study by Mitchell Van Elk and his colleagues that decided to test this exact hardware question.
Right.
They literally slid people into an fMRI scanner and showed them awe-inducing videos of vast natural scenes, things like massive waterfalls and sweeping space vistas.
Right, trying to simulate vastness.
Specifically to see what the default mode network would do in real time.
And what the fMRI data showed perfectly mirrored the behavioral studies. During the moments, participants reported feeling awe. The blood oxygenation and activity in the default mode network significantly dropped.
It's just turned off.
Basically, yeah. The self-referential machinery of the brain was literally turned down.
It's just wild.
The subjective, poetic feeling of the small self, you know, that sensation of your personal worries vanishing into the background, it has a hard, objective neural correlate.
Unbelievable.
There is physically less of your brain processing power devoted in that moment to constructing and maintaining your ego.
So the DMN is essentially like that background location tracking app on your smartphone.
Oh, I like that.
Like it's constantly running. It's always pinpointing exactly where you are in relation to everything else. And it drains a massive amount of your battery without you even realizing it.
Exactly.
So awe is basically a force quit command for the ego app. It suddenly frees up all that cognitive processing power so you can actually take in the massive external data of the outside world.
That's a great analogy. The brain uses a staggering amount of metabolic energy just to maintain the narrative of the self.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Awe is one of the rare, built-in, completely sober ways that human beings can loosen the grip of that default mode network.
Huh.
Just by encountering something perceptually vast enough, your brain naturally downregulates the machinery of your own ego to make room for accommodation.
The concept of downregulating the ego without any chemical intervention is the perfect bridge here, I think.
Definitely.
Because the article spends a significant portion of its runtime drawing this incredibly tight parallel between the neuroscience of awe and the neuroscience of psychedelics.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture of psychiatric research right now, the similarities between a state of deep awe and a psychedelic state are just impossible to ignore.
Yeah.
Readers of the ODTW Journal are likely following the Renaissance in psychedelic medicine, so they probably know what a profound psychedelic experience looks like under an fMRI.
Right, a lot of lower DMN activity.
Exactly. It involves a drastically quieted default mode network, a dissolved or highly diminished sense of personal identity, a sudden flood of deep meaning, a feeling of vast interconnectedness, and an experience so overwhelming that it forces a person to fundamentally update their internal model of reality.
Which is literally the definition of awe that we just walked through.
It is.
You could swap the labels on those two lists and not know the difference.
That exact realization led a researcher named Peter Hendricks to publish a major provocative hypothesis in 2018.
Oh, what did he say?
Hendricks proposed that awe might actually be the core mechanism underlying the clinical success of psychedelic-assisted therapy.
Oh, wow.
For years, researchers have noted that the patients who report experiencing a classic mystical experience during their psychedelic session are the ones who have the most dramatic recoveries from depression or addiction.
Right. The mystical experience is key.
Right. And Hendricks argued that this mystical experience is, at its core, simply an experience of overwhelming, profound awe. It's a vastness so total that it demands the deepest level of accommodation a human mind can possibly perform.
And the famous psychedelic phenomenon of ego dissolution, right? Where a person temporarily loses their sense of individual identity entirely, where the boundary between them and the room vanishes.
Yes.
Hendrix is suggesting that it is just a more extreme pharmacological version of the small self we experience when we look at the Milky Way.
Exactly. The therapeutic power that follows a supervised psychedelic session often looks like dramatic drops in treatment-resistant depression, the sudden softening of severe addiction, and a renewed, profound sense of connection to others.
Right.
Hendrix argues that this healing flows directly through the channel of awe.
Okay.
The vastness of the psychedelic experience forcefully shrinks the entrenched, ruminating self.
Because they're stuck in those loops.
Yes. Depression and addiction are often characterized by an incredibly rigid, hyperactive default mode network.
Mm.
People get stuck in tight loops of negative self-reflection.
That makes total sense.
When that ego is temporarily dissolved, a space opens up. In that space, a person can accommodate new perspectives and rebuild a wider, much healthier mental map of who they are and how they belong in the broader world.
Okay, so to make sure I'm tracking the nuance of this hypothesis correctly, is Hendrix suggesting that everyday awe is just a very mild psychedelic trip? Or is he saying that a psychedelic trip is basically a pharmacological shortcut to the exact same feeling you get standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon?
It's much closer to the latter, but neurologists tend to view them as two entirely different routes to the exact same neuropsychological event.
Okay.
That core event is the temporary relaxation of your predictive self model and the forced expansion of your mental frame.
Right.
Awe reaches that state psychologically, driven by sensory input from the outside world, you know, massive canyon, an overwhelming symphony, a starry night.
Right.
Psychedelics reach that exact same state pharmacologically, from the inside out.
Oh.
They bind to the brain's 5-HT2A serotonin receptors, creating an entropic loosening of the brain's habitual patterns. They make the mind briefly, radically plastic.
Wow.
But whether the trigger is a massive mountain range or a serotonin agonist, both routes arrive at a place where the rigid defensive structures of the ego become flexible and something much larger can be taken in.
It's a staggering way to reframe how we think about mental health and human perception.
It really is.
But the source material is also very careful to pull us back down to earth and include some honest scientific caveats about this research, which I think is crucial.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
We always have to look at the limitations of the data.
Yeah.
It's incredibly important to state that the neuroscience of awe is still a very young, developing field.
Right, and the article makes a really funny but accurate point about the methodology. It is genuinely difficult to induce a state of life-altering, mind-expanding awe while a participant is shoved inside a loud, claustrophobic fMRI tube.
Oh, for sure.
Like, showing someone a video of a waterfall on a tiny low-resolution screen while magnets bang around their head is a pretty pale substitute for actually standing in a redwood forest.
Definitely. And because of that, the effect sizes in the current fMRI literature are fairly modest, and the field is still actively working on how to replicate and refine these neuroimaging studies in more naturalistic ways.
Right.
We also have to acknowledge that vastness isn't always benevolent.
Right, like being scared of something huge.
Exactly. Psychologists have identified something they call threat-based awe.
Threat-based awe.
Think of the feeling of existential dread you get reading about the scale of a global pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
Or the terrifying feeling of smallness during a massive natural disaster like a hurricane.
Sure.
Or even the manufactured awe that authoritarian regimes use to manipulate populations through massive, synchronized military spectacles.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That type of vastness absolutely forces accommodation, and it shrinks the self, but it triggers the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight response.
Right.
Positive awe triggers the parasympathetic nervous system, giving you that chill response and goosebumps. Threat-based awe does not carry that same pro-social, kind-hearted glow.
Oh, I imagine not.
Being terrified by a tornado doesn't necessarily make you more likely to share your lunch.
Right. Getting shrunk by fear has a very different behavioral output than getting shrunk by beauty.
Precisely.
The article is also rigorous in noting that the specific link between psychedelics and awe is still a well-argued hypothesis. It is not a settled, immutable scientific fact yet.
Exactly. They clearly share overlapping neurological features, specifically regarding the default mode network. But to confidently declare that awe is the singular exclusive mechanism of psychedelic healing is a very strong claim that researchers are still designing trials to definitively prove.
So what does this all mean? If you're someone who can't exactly get out to a national park this weekend and you aren't signing up for a clinical psychedelic trial anytime soon, how do you actually trigger this mechanism on a random Tuesday? Like, what does this mean for our everyday lives?
It means that you possess a built-in biological mechanism for mental expansion that you can access at almost any time if you know what to look for. Awe is a highly trainable emotion, and it is abundant in everyday life. You don't have to rely on a mountain range. Researchers find that people can cultivate everyday awe in incredibly accessible ways.
The source lists some great examples. You can find it in complex music or by deeply engaging with visual art. You can find it in witnessing acts of moral beauty, like seeing a stranger do something incredibly selfless for someone else without expecting anything in return. You can find it in the slow, sudden reveal of a dense scientific idea that suddenly makes the universe make sense, or even just sitting quietly and really looking at the complexity of a child's face.
Yes, because awe reliably produces that small self and all of the downstream pro-social benefits that come with it. Deliberately seeking out vastness in your daily routine is one of the most reliable, lowest-cost psychological interventions we have to become less self-preoccupied. It's a tangible way to become more connected and generous. Our emotional spectrum evolved for a reason, and it increasingly appears that awe evolved specifically to keep the human ego from completely closing in on itself.
We spend so much of our waking lives just assimilating. We just try to fit every new email, every new interaction into the exact same mental map we already have, constantly reinforcing the rigid self we already are. What I find so compelling about this deep dive is realizing that awe is our mind's built-in emergency override to that closed loop.
It really is.
It is the precise moment the world exceeds our map, and our map has no choice but to grow. It makes us smaller, yes, but by shrinking us, it ultimately enlarges the world we get to live in.
This raises an important question, though, and it's a structural one I want to leave everyone thinking about. If positive awe is the specific psychological mechanism that forces our mental maps to expand, and if it's the specific biological tool that shrinks the ego and makes us less entitled and kinder to one another, we have to look at the environment we've built for ourselves today. Could the modern epidemic of rigid, polarized thinking, the constant digital self-obsession, and the deep cultural entitlement we see everywhere simply be a symptom of an awe-deprived society?
That reframes so much about how fractured our digital spaces are right now. We've essentially built an entire societal ecosystem, especially online, that is precision engineered to feed and agitate the ego with almost zero built-in awe to keep it in check.
If we aren't regularly encountering vast, profound things that force accommodation, if we aren't practicing that small self on a regular basis, do our individual egos simply swell up to fill the entire frame of our reality?
If the operating system never encounters an app that forces it to upgrade, it just stays stuck in its oldest, most rigid version, which makes stepping outside, away from the screens, and just looking up at a sky thick with stars seem a lot less like a poetic luxury and a lot more like a basic maintenance requirement for being a functional human being.
It is arguably the most human way we have to touch the vastness of the world and remember our actual place in it.
Definitely something to think about the next time you look up.